media. More climate reporting on the program can be found at BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. The Pueblo of Santa Ana in New Mexico has received a nearly $6.4 million federal grant to improve safety between wildlife and vehicles. The U.S. Department of Transportation Federal Highway Administration award is to help the tribe design wildlife overpasses, underpasses, or other features along nearly 8 miles of highway and 19 miles of interstate. The Pueblo, located near Albuquerque and Santa Fe, is one of 16 recipients to receive funding for wildlife crossing projects nationwide. The funding is through a new grant program and its second round of awards to improve safety for motorists and wildlife by reducing vehicle collisions. According to the Transportation Department, each year more than 1 million wildlife vehicle collisions are estimated to impact motorists and wildlife in the U.S. Wildlife vehicle collisions in the Pueblos area are said to include deer, elk, antelope, bears, and mountain lions. 16 bills investing in Native communities were passed by the U.S. Senate in 2024, led by U.S. Senator Brian Schatz, according to the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. The committee's highlighting billions of dollars in investments in housing and health care and support for Native lands, tourism, water rights, and bison restoration. Four bills were enacted into law. In a statement, Schatz, who's chair of the committee, said he's proud of the progress made during the year, but said the committee has a lot more work to do for Native communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 2nd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings, Lisa Loving, and Josh Salem. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell, so glad you chose to join us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. I'm Lisa Loving. It's time for the Christmas Bird Count. We're speaking with Joe Liebesite, Assistant Director of Statewide Conservation at the Bird Alliance of Oregon, and that's who's running it. Thanks for being here, Joe.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
First of all, the Oregon Bird Alliance used to be the Audubon Society, but local chapters around the country have changed their name to reflect different values, better values. But I have to tell you this, Joe. Over the weekend, there was a flock of varied thrushes in my yard, and they made a noise like nothing I've ever heard. It was like ethereal whistles. There were 60 or 70 of them. I just had to enthuse about birds.
Yeah, they go like this. Like that? Is that what you heard?
Well, it was like that times 70 or 80. See, somebody else said, did it sound like that? It sounded like that, but more so.
You can't recreate the sound of a bird that has the syrinx, which is like two vocal cords in one. So they can actually sing two songs at once. And it's hard to pick them apart unless you slow it down with a recorder.
I love talking to bird nerds. Okay, the Bird Alliance of Oregon. In my mind's eye, I see all kinds of birds. They're sitting around a conference table. They're having poppy seed bagels and that veggie tray from Costco, and they're talking about lobbying the state for better resources. No, seriously, what do you really do?
That's part of it. my job is as statewide conservation assistant director is to work on many different conservation issues around the state, from the coasts to our forests to the east side. We have staff that live on, we have someone in Pacific City who's running our monitoring of snowy plovers, endangered species that lives on the coast, and we're trying to recover that bird. We have a person down by Yahats at Cape Perpetua, and we have a sanctuary there. It's about 300 acres, and we've worked for many decades to try to protect that small parcel of land, but also connect the greater coastal forest down there, and you know, for species like the marbled murrelet, spotted owl. So we have a person there, and then on the east side, out in Burns, Oregon, way out in Harney County, we have a staff person that's working really closely with Fish and Wildlife and other entities as part of the High Desert Partnership to protect birds out in Malheur. Malheur National Wildlife Refuge has thousands, if not millions, of birds that come through it every year to migrate.
Okay, we could not even have this conversation without taking a moment to honor the legacy of Bob Salinger, the former conservation director of Oregon Bird Alliance, of course, famous all over the state, beloved all over the state, as the conservation director of the Audubon Society. So for decades, actually, it has to be said that Bob Salinger has probably shaped a lot of the conservation efforts, or even just what we know about it. Joe, can you talk a moment about how Bob impacted birds in our state and other other creatures too?
Yeah, well, first I want to say that it's been a tragedy to lose Bob at such a young age. He was 57, and he was my supervisor for almost a decade, and I learned so much from Bob in my time working with him. Everything from, he would do anything. He was a scientist. He was an advocate. He helped in protecting so many amazing places in our state, and no one can fill his shoes. We're going to do the best we can without him. But a couple things Bob helped do was help protect the Elliott State Forest from massive logging, and so it's not all said and done yet. But it looks like the Elliott State Forest is on a pathway for protecting large chunks of old growth habitat. He helped pass the Private Forest Accord, which is all of our private lands have really not very good regulations on logging. So part of the Private Forest Accord was us, our organization, working with a number of other conservation groups and with the timber industry to figure out how we can come to a way to provide better ways to manage our private forest lands. And part of that is, like, for example, having a wider buffer around all of our many streams that go through forest lands, because logging, when you have it right up to streams, will put so much sediment, reduce the water quality, not just for wildlife, but for people. So we took a small but important step in protections in our private lands, and Bob was instrumental to that. So those are two huge wins that, you know, there's still a lot more work to do, but that Bob had an incredibly important role to play in those.
When I think of Bob Salinger, I think of him climbing up the side of the Fremont Bridge, harnessed up there, and I'm afraid to even drive across it. So that's how I think of him. But the other thing, and we could do a whole show about Bob Salinger, but I also want to say that...
And I'm not even talking about the urban conservation work.
Right.
We live in Portland, and so I have to say that, Bob's work for over, three decades to help... and with people like Mike Houck as well to help, and Micah Meskel, who's still with us at Bird Alliance, to, try to make our city the greenest city in the country. A lot of the work they did to protect green spaces and to ensure that we have places that are accessible to the public and are great for wildlife, but are great for people too in our city to enjoy wildlife. So I have to say that as well.
And just one more thing on this. When I look across, I'm not the queen of environmentalism, but everyone who lives in Oregon is kind of an environmentalist, whether you know it or not. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to cry right now. When I started seeing the salmon coming up the stream because the dams were blown up, like, that is the most incredible thing I've seen in my lifetime in the state. And I I know this sounds grandiose, but I have a feeling that he had a piece of that too, mm-hmm. because he was the one always talking about why is it important to keep the trees and everything near the water there, because if you don't, they make the water muddy and it makes the water unlivable for salmon. And even though we might have said, you know, hopefully future salmon, you mean, now they're coming back. Mm-hmm. And this is blowing my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's in a time that's very difficult right now for a lot of reasons. Bob's passing and you know, a new administration that's not going to be very environmentally friendly. I think seeing something like that and giving us hope is really important. It's amazing how fast, after 100 years with these dams in place, they come out, and within months, we have salmon running back up the river, or up the Klamath River. And so it's just a great, we have to hang on to those things right now in this difficult time. And I think there is a lot of hope.
Okay, now for the fun stuff. Tell us about the Christmas bird count. What could that possibly be?
So the Christmas bird count has been around for over 100 years. It started in 1900. And prior to that, many people in rural areas mostly would go out, and they would go out and shoot birds. And I don't know why they did it. I think it was partly because people living in farms thought of birds as pests, and during the Christmas time they would go out and shoot birds. And so that was kind of the dawn of our time to think about their environmental movement, you know. And someone at one point came up and said, I think it was Frank Chapman, who started the National Audubon many years ago, said, hey, you know what, instead of killing birds, why don't we just count them? And, you know, that was an inspiration to a lot of people. And the first count was started in 1900. And people would go out and count and identify all the birds they could see within a certain radius in an area. And it started out with just a few counts back in 1900. And now we have thousands of what they call Christmas bird count circles, or 15-mile circle, that you do that. And the great thing about it is that it's a great community science or citizen science effort where anyone can help out. You don't have to be a great birder, because what we try to do is we try to pair up experienced birders with people that are just beginning. And so if you're in a group of, say, five people, and you're going to cover, say, we're going to cover Mount Tabor, you'll have the experienced birders that can help educate and, you know, talk to the new birders about what we're seeing. The new birders can keep the list. They can be the ones dictating, recording all the data. And also, I think most people can identify a crow or a robin. So it's a great jumping off point for beginning birders to, you know, start to ramp up their experience, learn more new bird species, and, you know, have a sense of community with people while we collect all this information.
If you just tuned in, I'm Lisa Loving, and we are talking with Joe Liebezite. He's the Assistant Director of Statewide Conservation at Bird Alliance of Oregon. And we started getting into the bird count. I want to ask more concrete questions about people who, how people participate, in a minute. But first, I wanted to say, what are some of the biggest issues our birds are facing?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the biggest issues our birds are facing is, you know, habitat loss, for example, you know, deforestation, transformation of different habitats into places that birds can't really live in, and climate is a big issue. And I think the Christmas bird count is an example of a community science or citizen science project that can help us get towards understanding climate impacts. And the reason is because when you have so many people contributing, you have much more power. You know, when you have a few scientists doing a study, you can only answer so many questions because you can only cover so much ground. But when you have a network of many people, just regular people going out and doing the bird count, you can pull that data together over long periods of time, over huge regions, over the whole nation, and look at patterns of how are birds doing. And that's just what the Christmas bird count has done over the years. You know, like I said before, it's been going on for 120 years. It happens all across North America, Canada, even down into Mexico and other countries at this point. So scientists have used that information to get a better handle on what's going on with our bird populations. And we've noticed that, first of all, a lot of bird numbers are going down. There was a study back in 2014 looking at climate change specifically, and we looked at, with Christmas bird count data and also with breeding bird data combined, we looked at over 588 North American bird species. About half of them, 314 of them, are potentially going to lose more than 50% of their climate habitat or range because of climate change. And we couldn't have understood that without this big data set to look at bird populations on such a large regional scale. And so with that information, we can start to develop ways to, how do we save these birds? You know, how do we, what can we do to, you know, change our, to do restoration in habitats that needed to get done? It helps us prioritize areas that we need to do our, need to do work to help these bird species. And for us, really, because birds are just
we called them an indicator species.
They're an indicator, right? Right. If the birds are not doing well, it's probably an indication that we're not going to be doing well either.
I saw the story, I feel as if it was last week, about how half of Alaska's common murres died as a result of a marine heat wave a few years ago. It's like millions of birds. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these impacts happen, and it's like, I hate to put it like this, if a tree falls in a forest and there's nobody there, does it make a sound? And I also want to briefly say, when we say citizen science, we don't mean you don't have to have any papers, you don't have to have, you know, a green card or anything like that. I think it's possible that just about anybody who would like to participate, including kids and families, mm-hmm. are welcome to participate. But when you bring in people, everyday people, mm-hmm. to help with this count, you're putting us in charge of the birds.
Mm-hmm.
It
mm-hmm.
hits different. It hits.
Yeah,
different.
I think, you know, a big thing of what we do at Bird Alliance is, we need to build constituents. We need to build people that care about the places they live. I think, you know, more and more in our day and age, people are, they put a lot of their focus on screens, whether it be their iPhone or their television screen. And this gets people outdoors. It gets them to see our amazing wildlife we have, even in our urban areas. I mean, you just saw that flock of varied thrushes, which, you know, inspired you. So we get people out, we get them to appreciate wildlife and to start caring about the neighborhoods they live in. And so I think that's the power of community science. And that's one of the big powers of just getting people engaged and caring. And so when we do have those legislative priorities that we want people to support, they'll come out and do that. The other part is the science part, is that we get people to actually record data that we provide to National Audubon, and we can answer those big questions.
I was just going to ask you, where does the data go? And then after that, I want to start asking you, like, what is it exactly like to participate?
Yeah.
What do you use the data for?
So we collect the data, and again, it's just the number of birds that we see within this 15-mile circle, and the species that we've identified. And we collate all that information. So in Portland, we do the Christmas bird count this year. It'll be actually in 2025 on January 4th, Saturday, January 4th. And we all get together at the end of that night. We have five different areas. We break the Portland 15-mile circle into five different areas. And there's five different leaders. And these are mostly volunteers. We have a couple staff person that help too. We get together, we have some pizza, and everyone says what their collective group saw. We combine all that data together, and we send it to National Audubon. Now, that's just the Portland CBC. There's 1,000 other CBCs that people are doing that they're going to provide their data to National Audubon the same way. So there'll be this massive database with all the birds that were seen in these circles all over the Western Hemisphere, really. And that information is then used by scientists in any way they want. It's freely available for scientists to use to do analyses, to look at things like, how are birds shifting their range due to climate change? Where are they living now versus decades ago? How is their population increasing or decreasing? Those are some of the questions we can help answer.
There's also a Bee City USA, people doing the same thing with bees, which is, mm-hmm. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there's this thing with humans that we often think somebody else is going to fix that. We often mm-hmm. think somebody else is in charge of that. It's not me. And mm-hmm. yet I feel like we kind of are in charge of it. Okay. Now I'm going to say, how do you do it? Like, what do people do? And are they doing it in other cities?
So, like I said, the Portland CBC is on the first Saturday in January, which I think is January 5th. And You can go to our website, birdallianceoregon.org, and if you go to the Get Involved section and then go down to Community Science, and then in there you'll see the Christmas Bird Count page. You click on that and you can read all about how to prepare for the count. And if you scroll down on that webpage, there's a list of our area leaders. There's five different, like I said before, the Portland count is split into five different areas. So if you want to do a count in Southeast, you get in touch with the area leader for Southeast. If you want to do a count up in North Portland, you reach that person, and we'll get you on a team, and then we'll learn about your experience level. Are you an experienced birder or are you not? We'll try to pair you up on a team of birders that has a nice assortment of people with different skill levels, and then we'll have you go out during that day. You go out in the morning, and someone will have a data form, and we'll be recording the data, and we can switch between people to record data if someone gets tired of doing it. Everyone have binoculars, and you go out, and within your area, we'll have a map of the area that you cover. So I mentioned before there's five different area leaders, but within each area, we have sub-areas. So like in Southeast Portland, that's one area, but within that area, it's split into 10 sub-areas. And so we have teams in each of those sub-areas covering a chunk of Southeast Portland. And so we get over 300 people typically participating in the Portland Christmas Bird Count every year, which I think has been in some years the highest participation level of anywhere in any Christmas Bird Count. So that's doing a field count. That's if getting out in the field. A lot of people don't want to do it for the full day. They might start out in the morning or sunrise. And sunrise, don't forget, in the winter is like 7:45. Yeah, yeah. So it's not that early. And then you go out a lot of people like to go out until lunchtime, and then they can stop, or people can go the whole day until sundown, which is what I like to do. The other way you can participate, if you don't want to go outside and you just want to count birds at your bird feeder, there's a feeder watch. So there's a link on our website to how to participate in the feeder watch, and there's a very simple protocol where you can just, you go to your bird, you look outside your window, you don't have to have a bird feeder. You go look outside in your backyard and you count the birds you see for like a certain set period of time, like 10 minutes. Then you take a break and then you go back and you do that a few times. And that's basically the feeder watch count. So if you don't want to move around, you want to stay sedentary and just look out your window, you can still do it.
I love that. I'm not saying that's what I would do. So as I'm thinking, it would be so fun to get out of the house.
Yeah.
It's one day. It's only one day.
Yeah.
That day is January 4th, 2025. And so I'm visualizing people, maybe they're sort of in hiking clothes, but they don't have, you know, it doesn't have to be fancy hiking clothes. You got to be able to walk a couple mm-hmm. miles. People need binoculars as a thing.
Yeah, and we do have some binoculars that sometimes we can lend out. So I can't promise that we have a ton of them, but we do have some. Yeah.
What kind of birds are we going to see on January 4th? Like, what's up there?
Yeah, so this time of year, all the migrant birds, most of the migrant birds that go down south are no longer here. So things like the western tanager Wilson's warblers, a lot of the warblers are south for the winter. They're in places like Central America or South America. But we do have a lot of resident birds now that stay here year-round. And we have some birds that migrate from places like the Arctic to come down here and call this their wintering ground. So some of the resident species we get here are things like, you know, black-capped chickadees.
I love them. They're lucky. They're lucky guys.
We get the varied thrush. We get robins, American robins. We get American crows. We get bald eagles are here, peregrine falcons. Some of the birds that come from that breed up in the Arctic that come down here are things like snow geese. So if you do a count out like on Sauvie Island, there is a Christmas bird count out there, you'll see lots of snow geese. You'll see sandhill cranes. We typically get over 115 species detected on the Portland Christmas bird count when you combine everybody's totals all together every year. So that's a lot of different species, a lot of different waterfowl, a lot of different songbirds. And I could probably go on and mention more, a bunch more, but
Joe, birds, like, we just think of them as being so fragile, and they are, of course, but they're mighty. Like, mm-hmm. they do incredible things that we as humans could never do. Can you just talk about that a little as we're out there looking at the birds?
Yeah, I mean,
like, what have they done just to even be there?
Think about a hummingbird. You know, we have a hummingbird here called the Anna's hummingbird.
I was going to mention.
So this tiny little bird that weighs a gram or so can actually survive our winters here. And they can actually go, when it gets very cold, they can find a little crevice to hide in a tree and go into torpor. It's a type of like hibernation for overnight. They like slow their heart rate down because they need to eat a lot, as you might imagine, to keep their metabolism going. But you just think of this tiny little guy that they can make it through the winters here in the Northwest. So that's one example of how, yes, they can be seemingly fragile, but they're also super resilient. Kind of like those salmon that have come up the Klamath, you know, after the Klamath being closed off for 100 years. Birds are amazing in that way. They can come into an area and come back. Now, we have some birds that really do well in an urban environment, like crows and pigeons. They have some birds that have a harder time, you know, have a harder time in urban environments.
It's a funny thing about urban birds, because I know a lot of people, a surprising number of people, who have a relationship with the crows in their yard.
Yeah.
And there's even clubs and groups of people that do nothing but share photographs of the random things that crows dropped on their porches. Like, a lot of people, maybe as humans, a lot of us want to know we belong here. We're looking for a sense of belonging. And it's more than just, you know, do I have a credit card that lets me go to Ulta Beauty Shop? It's like, no, I'm a piece of nature too. Mm-hmm. And this is where I fit in.
Crows are amazing. People, there's so many great stories about crows because they're so intelligent. I mean, I have seen crows dropping walnuts from the telephone line and waiting for a car to go over the walnut and then going down and eating the inside of the nut. So it's amazing what they do. And, you know, we see them fly every night to the west because they roost in the park blocks trees. And it's an important place for them to hang out during the winter every night. And they're just incredible creatures.
I had a yard sale this summer, and a few people came who were witches. I'm being real right with you right now. And they took a moment to go over to the telephone pole and just like hang out with the crows, mm-hmm. which was fine. Mm-hmm. And the crows were responding to them. I'm not imagining that. Okay. So we've talked a little bit about the Christmas bird count. It's mm-hmm. a one-day thing. Mm-hmm.
And there are multiple Christmas bird counts. So if you go on to the Oregon Birders Association, a different group, but there's a group of birders that have an Oregon Birders Association. If you go onto their website, I think they have a webpage on all the other counts that are going on. Like last weekend, I helped on the Gresham Christmas bird count. There, and I think last weekend was the Tillamook Christmas bird count. So you can go on the Oregon Birders Association page and look at the other counts that are happening. All the counts happen between December 14th and January 5th every year. That's the kind of the window, the two-week window that National Audubon says they have to be done in order to, you know, keep it to that period of time in the winter.
Joe, so what kind of people should be participating?
Really, anybody. I mean, I think we want to have this as open and inclusive to any kind of person. So, like I said before, you don't need to have any experience as a birder. You just have to have an interest in doing it. You have to be willing to get up in the morning and go out. It might be a little rainy. We do it rain or shine. So just bring, you know, be prepared for that. Wear good boots and layers of clothes. But yeah, it can, you know, kids are invited. I had my older daughter, who is now 15, when she started doing the Christmas bird count when she was about 7. And last year she didn't do it, but she's done it pretty much every year. And so it's great for kids. It's great for pretty much anybody, really. And like I said before, if you have mobility issues, you can help out by doing the feeder count. So I think it's pretty much open to really, really, really anybody.
All right, wrapping it up right now. Mm-hmm. One more time, tell everyone how we participate, and it doesn't even matter where you are. One more time, tell us how we participate.
You can participate in the Portland Christmas Bird Count by going to our webpage. So it's birdallianceoregon.org. I'll say that again, birdallianceoregon.org. Go to the Get Involved page. You'll see that up on the menu at the top. When you click in Get Involved, you go to the Community Science page. When you click on Community Science, you'll see the Christmas Bird Count thumbnail. Click on that. You can learn all about the count there. And if you scroll down, you'll see the five area leaders for the different parts of Portland. So if you're in North Portland and you want to stay in North Portland, you reach out to the person that's in their area is North Portland. If you want to try somewhere else, you'll see the contact info for those people in there. Reach out to them, send them an email. Some of them have their phone numbers, and they'll get you on a team and be happy to answer your questions. And I'm happy to answer questions as well. If you want to email me, my job is to coordinate the count with a woman named Candace Larson. So our contact information is on the website. You can reach us, and we're happy to help you find a team that fits your needs.
Thanks for being with us, Joe.
You're welcome.
That was Joe Liebezeit from the Bird Alliance of Oregon. Again, the Christmas bird count is January 4th, 2025. Find out more online at birdallianceoregon.org. Thanks for tuning in. Stay with us.
Mr. and Mrs. Radioland, I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I will